The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, if God really exists, why doesn't he just come down from heaven? Why does he come down to earth and make himself known? Why not come down in mighty power with a thunderous voice accompanied by miracles instead of making people believe in him by faith? Wouldn't people rather hear from God himself instead of some obnoxious Christian telling them that there's a God all the time? Why doesn't God just do it himself? Well, my friend, that is just exactly what God did. That was plan one. Plan one didn't go too well, but in the days of Moses, the Almighty came down to Mount Sinai with trumpets, with fire, with a thunderous voice, with a big black cloud of smoke, with all the Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, industrial light and magic special effects, and the people were freaked out. They said, Moses, we can't handle this. You go up to the mountain and listen to God and then come down and tell us what he said. So Moses did just as the people asked. He went up on the mountain and listened to God for 40 days and 40 nights. At that time, God gave him the rest of his laws. Incidentally, there are some 300 commandments, not merely 10. The significance of the 10 commandments is that they were the first 10 and only 10 God got through before the people stopped him and asked Moses to go up and listen to the rest of them. Now get this, you gotta love this. When Moses returned with God's law, the people had chosen to worship a golden calf. They rejected Moses, sounding not unlike many of today's falsely religious. Now, how do we know Moses really talked to God? Moses, you're saying your view of God is better than our view of God? Who are you to judge our view of God? And Moses said to them, this was your idea. Your idea of having God communicate through a spokesman, me, and from now on, that is the way things will continue to be. God is going to send such spokesmen on a regular basis, and they will be called prophets. Now, that's a rough paraphrase, of course. Here are the actual words shared by Moses before he died in something not unlike a farewell State of the Union address to the Hebrews. I'm reading from Deuteronomy chapter 18. Moses is looking out over the crowd. And he says, the nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him. For this is what you asked of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly when you said, let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor see this great fire anymore, or we will die. The Lord said to me, what they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their fellow Israelites, and I will put my words in his mouth. I will tell them everything I command him. I myself will call to account anyone who does not listen to my words, and the prophet speaks in my name. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, is to be put to death. Now, the good news is that under the New Covenant or New Testament, although God will at times continue to send prophets, he now speaks to all of us directly again through the comforting voice of his Holy Spirit. I'm reading from 1 John chapter 4, verse 13. It says, this is how we know that we live in him and he in us. He has given us his Spirit. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you.
Call Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. If you have questions or comments about anything we talk about on this program, you can always reach me on Facebook, Twitter, or online, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. Let me read a few comments from some regular listeners. This is from Helen. She says, "You have great bumper music. Could you list them? Where do you get them? Some sound like movie themes. Love your show. I listen almost every Sunday PM." Almost every Sunday, Helen? You listen almost? Okay. Actually, thank you very much. I'm glad you listen often. And I'm also glad that you enjoy the bumper music. Although mostly a talk show, I do like to do a lot with music. And you may have noticed that occasionally I will even play an entire song over the air. But even when merely transitioning in and out of a break, I play the music longer than bumper music is usually played on a talk show. It is one of the perks to having a radio show that I can play pieces that are my own personal favorites. The music, as you've probably noticed, is very eclectic, united only by the fact that I am playing music I personally like. I do try to balance fast rock-style pieces with slower, mellow music. My weekly theme song that opens and closes the show is from the motion picture Exodus. As far as bumper music goes, I have different sets so that you're not hearing the same each week, but the sets alternate in return, which means you will hear them again, but probably not until a few weeks later. Now, Helen, the music you heard a few weeks ago when you wrote me this email is music that I'm going to go ahead and play again tonight so that I can refer to it in real time. And it will indeed include some motion picture soundtracks, Day of the Dolphin and The Last Samurai. You're also hearing some 60s, 70s rock. We already heard The Mamas and the Papas, California Dreaming, and The Doors with Touch Me. Coming up later in the program, Paul McCartney, Live and Let Die. In addition, a piece from the off-Broadway musical Godspell will be played today, along with Paul Myriad and his orchestra, Love is Blue, and a special version of Scarborough Fair by Celtic Woman. Usually when I use a vocal piece of pop music, I still play the musical bridge in between, which is why the song may not always be easily recognizable. As for where I get them, well, most of them are from my own CD collections. Of course, you can always go and listen to these off of YouTube at any times, or buy them and add them to your collection from iTunes. Anyway, thank you again, Helen, for listening. And this is from another listener, Joey. He says, "Hello, Bob. I have listened to your show from time to time on AM 1170 and just wanted to thank you for your wisdom and your extremely informative service to the Christian community. Now, here's my question. In the past, I've heard you mention a class at Skyline Church. Can you please tell me more about this class? Is this class going to be offered again or is it ongoing? Thank you, sir, for your time, Joey." Well, thank you, Joey, for the kind words about my radio program. And yes, my class at Skyline is ongoing, and we would love to have you join us. We meet in room 412 of the lower building at 10:30 on Sunday morning. Some come earlier at 10 o'clock for snacks and a time to get to know others. We hope to see you there. And of course, to anyone else listening who may be in the San Diego area, you're welcome to come as well. I know that over the internet, people hear us all over the country. It'd probably be a little bit of a stretch for some of you, but if you're in the San Diego area, want to join us for my class, we'd love to have you. Now, this next one is from Stan, who's obviously responding to a lot of the political programs we've done the last few weeks. He says, "Hi, Bob. Why have Christians made this election so complicated? The choice is simple. You are voting either for the persecution of Christians or against the persecution of Christians. If the Christians can be led to see this simple truth, rather than getting caught up in the mainstream media barrage of lies and deception, we win. Best Stan in Claremont. P.S. This explains Obama, Hillary, Soros, etc." And then he has a quote from Leon Trotsky, who was a Marxist revolutionary. It says, "In order to prevent further war, the proletariat must form a United States of Europe and then go on to struggle for the creation of a United States of the world." Well, interesting thoughts, Stan. Thank you for sharing and thank you for listening. Now, earlier on the program today, I showed how it was not God's original intention to have prophets. Interestingly enough, God not only intended Israel to go without prophets, he originally intended them to go without kings as well. True, he used originally human judges. Generally, these were heroes who rose to Israel's defense during a time of crisis. Some judges proved to be better than others, and certainly bad judges could always be removed. Nevertheless, God did not want Israel to have a permanent king in the place of a temporary judge. There was to be no kingly dynasty because God himself would rule as their king. That was the idea. Israel would have none of this. Failing to appreciate the unique relationship made available through the one and only God of the universe, they nevertheless opted to be like all other nations. And other nations had kings. I'm reading from 1 Samuel chapter 8. "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel." Now, Samuel was a prophet and a judge in Israel. "They came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Now make us a king to judge us like the other nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them.' So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, 'This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage, and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Lord will not hear you in that day.' Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the other nations, and our king may judge us and go up before us and fight our battles.' And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed their voice and make them a king.'" Okay, folks, this unusual twist of events actually teaches us much about God and his relationship to our prayers. The first observation should be very sobering. The second, believe it or not, embodies a marvelous hope. But first, as Christians, we tend to think of life as a choice in two categories. Something is either a sin or not a sin. Apparently, there is a third category. Things that are less than ideal, different than what God would prefer, but not necessarily a sin. Israel was already quite familiar with sin. Some of her sins are even mentioned in this passage, such as idol worship. Asking for a king was not as bad as worshiping a false deity, but neither was God wild about their request. Nevertheless, God would not have involved himself in the process of king selection if this was a sin, because obviously God does not participate in sin. This narrative has tremendous implications toward our prayer lives. While encouraged to bring our petitions and requests before God, we need to also spend some time listening to his desire and purpose for our lives. If not, God could answer our prayers in a manner that gives us what we wanted, even though he himself would have preferred something different. Now, why would God allow this? Well, in Israel's case, it was to teach them that they needed no king, that he was already their king, and to think twice before asking for something God had already told them that they'd be better off without. It wasn't a sin, but he's just saying you'd be better off. You don't really want to do this. Nothing was inherently wrong with having a king, but any honest 2020 hindsight shows how Israel's history would have gone much more smoothly without all these kings. Be that as it may, God honored their request. Through Samuel the prophet, acting under God's direction, a man named Saul was chosen as the first king of Israel. Now, Saul's reign started out good, but later it was horrible. It derailed when he became disobedient to some specific instructions of God during the battle. And so, God sent Samuel out to anoint another man as Saul's replacement. This simple shepherd, David, eventually became a mighty king. Also flawed, David, nevertheless, was a man after God's own heart. He is still known today as the greatest king Israel ever had, and yet one greater than David was promised. From David's seed, the ultimate king, the final king, the eternal king of Israel will someday rule. That's predicted in Jeremiah chapter 23. This person has come. This person visited Israel once before in 33 AD. This person known as Jesus, the Messiah, or Christ. Israel rejected Jesus, failing to understand that before the Messiah can rule as king, he must first die for Israel's sins, and not only Israel's, but the sins of the entire world. After this, he would return and rule Israel someday in the future. And Isaiah chapter 53 talks about both roles of the Messiah, that of a sacrifice, that is a ruling king. Although miraculously born of a virgin and without a physical human father, Jesus was still the blood descendant of David, since his mother Mary was related to David. Now, this leads us to our second observation, a rather obvious one, but also a fantastic truth to behold. Jesus will someday rule Israel. And who is Jesus? God himself. God incarnate. God in the form of a man. Why didn't God want Israel to have a king? Because he was already their king. He still did as they asked and provided a whole lineage of kings, one of whom would be their final ruler. This final ruler, Jesus, is God by identity. So it happens after all. Israel gets her way. God gets his way. Israel gets her king. Israel finally gets the only king God wanted her to have, himself. The love and wonder of God is so powerfully displayed here. God may give us something we want, something that in and of itself is not a sin, but less than his ideal design for our lives. In time, we find ourselves wondering why we ever made such a tunnel vision request. We learn to be careful what to wish for. And yet when all is said and done, still God gets us to where he wanted us to be. We might have been better off if we cooperated with his shortcut, but he also does quite well with the scenic route. Romans chapter 8 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose." Now, while we're on the subject of the kingship of Jesus, this topic kind of segues into another question, and I get this question often when I do talks for skeptics. Aren't the genealogies of Jesus in Matthew and Luke a contradiction? They give different names for Joseph's father. Two different fathers, and after that, the rest of the lineage is also listed differently. Now, at a first glance, this does indeed look like a contradiction. Matthew 1:16, I'm reading from the portion of the genealogy that talks about Joseph. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. Now looking at the genealogy in Luke, Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 24. Now Jesus himself was about 30 years old when he began his ministry. He was the son, so it was thought, of Joseph, the son of Heli, the son of Mathat. Now in all probability, Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy rather than Joseph. You're going, yeah, but Bob, it doesn't say that. Luke also calls Jesus the son of Joseph. Well, it does say son so-called. So you got to realize right away, the writer is aware of who he's talking about and what he's saying here. But you need to know this. In ancient Judaism, if a man had no son, his son-in-law was viewed as his son, and this same man received his inheritance. Sorry, ladies, that was a very patriarchal culture. That doesn't mean I'd want to see that happen in our culture today. I'm just saying that was the culture in the Bible. Therefore, Heli might actually be the father of Mary, and it would have been considered just as proper to call him the father of Joseph, especially in a genealogy. Now, evidence for this plausible theory can be found by turning to the pages of the Jerusalem Talmud. That's an ancient rabbinical commentary that tends to paint Jesus and his mother Mary with derogatory strokes. In the Talmud, Mary is actually referred to as the daughter of Heli. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric.
Looking for a new book you won't be able to put down? Push the Winds Around is a romance set in the context of science fiction. Dr. Brandon Krieger is given the opportunity of a lifetime, a psychologist's dream. Through the usage of his physics professor friend's time machine, Brandon travels 20 years back through time in an attempt to change one man's destiny. Tom Kyle, a convicted and unremorseful murderer, is located in the past when he was a 6-year-old boy. Brandon's mission? To alter Tom Kyle's path and prevent him from being a vicious killer. Matters are complicated when Brandon finds himself falling in love with young Tom's mother. Push the Winds Around, a novel by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We live in an interesting world today, a world where people just assume that religion doesn't have anything to do with facts. It's all about blind faith. Occasionally, I'll meet a skeptic that says, if the Bible's really the word of God, it shouldn't contradict itself. Now, believe it or not, I actually appreciate it when somebody says that to me, because it means, A, that they're thinking, and B, that they're considering religion as something to think about. If there really is a God, then that's a reality. It's not a blind faith. it's not a fantasy. On the other hand, it is kind of interesting. The minute somebody finds one contradiction in the Bible, now I don't believe the Bible has contradictions. I call them alleged contradictions. If you go to my website, bobsiegel.net, you can find all kinds of articles that deal with alleged Bible contradictions. But I do think it's fair if somebody says, if this is really the word of God, it ought to be consistent. If God's not schizophrenic, then he shouldn't say one thing here and then completely contradict himself. What's interesting, though, is when one religion contradicts another, when Christianity contradicts Hinduism or contradicts Judaism or contradicts Islam, people go, oh, well, that doesn't matter. It's beautiful, all these different religions, and God could be communicating in different ways. You have to stop and marvel at that, don't you? On one hand, people say it doesn't matter that we have 10 different religions and they're saying contradictory things. But boy, if the Bible's really the word of God, there shouldn't be one contradiction. Now, that's where I don't see the consistency, my friend. That's where I see a contradiction. Anyway, the contradiction du jour, the contradiction in question, the contradiction for today, was the genealogies of Jesus. They give the genealogies of Joseph, and they list Jacob as Joseph's father in the Gospel of Matthew. They list Heli as Joseph's father in the Gospel of Luke. But I mentioned that in those days, if a man did not have a daughter, his son-in-law was considered his son and given his inheritance. So at this point, we could speculate and say maybe Heli is Joseph's father-in-law. Well, what started out as speculation becomes verified when we turn to the Talmud, an ancient commentary that was oral in Jesus' day and later on got put in writing, saying derogatory things about Jesus and Mary, but acknowledging that they lived and calling Mary the daughter of Heli. Isn't that interesting? Still leaves a question, though. Why would God have given us both genealogies? This excellent question has a fascinating answer. Although not his blood father, Joseph was Jesus's legal father, and Joseph was related to King David. Now, I mentioned before our break that the Messiah had to be related to King David and be of that line. David, of course, had many wives and therefore many children. As a result, not all of his offspring were in the kingly line. But the Messiah had to be both a blood descendant of King David and legal heir through the kingly line. Now then, Mary, Jesus' mother, was also related to King David. And although Jesus may have been born of a virgin and Joseph may have been the adopted father, Mary was his literal blood mother. So Mary is related to King David, which means Jesus is related to King David, but not through the kingly line. The two genealogies tell us something very interesting about Jesus' credentials. Jesus was a literal blood descendant of King David, not through the kingly line because of his brother Mary, but he was also a legal descendant of David through the kingly line to his adoptive father, Joseph. Because when you trace Joseph back up there, you see him going to David through the kingly line. Now, why is all this relevant? Because the last king of Judah, prior to the destruction of the nation, at the hands of the Babylonians, because they had stopped worshiping the real God and had turned to idols, so God allowed the Babylonians to attack them. That last king of Judah was not a very good king. He was a man named King Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin did not walk with God, and as a result, God predicted through the prophet Jeremiah that none of Jehoiachin's descendants would ever sit on the throne of Israel. I'm reading from the book of Jeremiah, chapter 22. Verses 28 through 30. Is this man Jehoiachin a despised broken pot, an object no one wants? Why will he and his children be hurled out, cast into a land they do not know? Oh, land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says. Record this man as if childless, a man who will not prosper in his lifetime, for none of his offspring will prosper. None will sit on the throne of David or rule anywhere in Judah. Now we have an even bigger paradox. If the Messiah must be related to King David and legal heir through the kingly line, then he must also be related to King Jehoiachin. But the Jehoiachin curse prohibits further kings of Israel, for none of Jehoiachin's children can sit on the throne. That's made very clear. Ladies and gentlemen, the virgin birth solves our paradox. Jesus is a literal blood descendant of King David through his mother, but not through the kingly line. Therefore, the Jehoiachin curse does not affect him. Still, the Messiah had to be a legal heir to the throne, and Jesus is legally related to David through Joseph. But since it is legal only and not a blood relation, the Jehoiachin curse still does not touch him. The Bible has been around a long time. Often what seems like a contradiction to us is worked out by a wonderful God who loves to startle and amaze his followers. Messianic prophecy has been fulfilled through the miracle of the virgin birth. That seems to be the reason for the two different genealogies, and that is one of the reasons why the Messiah needed to be born of a virgin. It's funny, when I get into discussions with my fellow Jews, and I have so much trouble accepting Jesus. When I was in Israel a few years ago, I had a Jewish tour guide, very interesting guy, brilliant guy, nice guy. His family actually escaped from France, escaped the Holocaust, and made their way to Israel. And he was saying to me that he just couldn't understand why anybody could accept something so fantastic as the virgin birth. Well, you know, a lot of Jews today are atheists and agnostic. He wasn't, interestingly enough. He was an Orthodox Jew. There aren't really that many Orthodox Jews in Israel, but he was one of them. So I started going through Old Testament miracles. Do you believe in the parting of the Red Sea? Do you believe Daniel was saved from the lion's den? Do you believe that the waters in Jericho stopped? I went on and on. He believed all those things. I said, that's interesting. Why are you able to accept these miracles and not those? It was almost like the left side of the brain wasn't communicating to the right side of the brain. It was like, I think we get really conditioned with these things. The other problem that my Jewish friends have with Jesus is they say, well, why do they have to be two comings? Why are there two comings of the Messiah? Why not one? Well, first of all, originally it was going to be one. If the people had accepted Jesus and gotten behind him, the Romans under Pontius Pilate would still have executed Jesus without the help of the Jewish Sanhedrin, which didn't like him. If the Jewish Sanhedrin, the rulers of Israel, had gotten behind Jesus and endorsed him, believe me, Pilate, for political reasons, would have been scared enough to go ahead and have Jesus crucified anyway. So he still would have paid for everybody's sins. He still would have risen from the dead, but he would have hung around, and he would have gotten rid of the Romans at that time.
Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others sadly do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us.
Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m.
When my fellow Jews tell me they have trouble with two comings of Jesus, a first and a second, I remind them, first of all, that it was only meant to be one coming. If Israel had accepted Christ the first time, he would have stayed around. He would have become king. However, it didn't work out that way. There are going to be two comings, but I have to also challenge them. What is so hard about the idea of a hero coming twice? Did you know that they expect the return of Elijah? Elijah the prophet, unlike most of us, was one of two people in the Bible to be taken up into heaven without experiencing physical death. The other one is Enoch. But there's a lot more folklore about Elijah than Enoch. And there's this expectation, a founded expectation, that before the Messiah comes, Elijah the prophet will return to kind of announce him. Now, that's because at the end of the book of Malachi, the last words of the Old Testament, Malachi says, I will send Elijah the prophet before the great day of the Lord. Now, after that, Israel didn't have a prophet for 400 years. The next prophet to come was John the Baptist. Have you ever wondered when you get to the Gospels why there's such a crowd out there talking to John the Baptist? Because, A, this is the first time God's talked to Israel. Remember, it was their idea to have prophets. That's how God does it. Now, this is the first time God sent a prophet to Israel in 400 years. But also, they were told that when the Messiah comes, it might be Elijah. That's why people went up to John the Baptist and they actually asked him if he was Elijah. He denied being Elijah. That is, he's not an incarnation of Elijah, but he is, according to Jesus, an Elijah the second, somebody who came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. But my point is, Jewish people believe in two comings of Elijah. So much so that if you go to a Seder, if you go to a Passover service, they have a cup of wine and a place at the table set for Elijah every year. They've been doing this for 2,000 years in case Elijah returns and crashes the party. So I say to my Jewish brethren, you have no problem with two comings of Elijah. What about Moses? Did you know there was the first and second coming of Moses? Moses was 40 years old when he was banished from Egypt. He returned 40 years later when he was 80. Moses was a prince. When he discovered his Hebrew heritage, can you just imagine from a human point of view, he's thinking, my people are slaves, and yet nobody knew I was a slave. I was adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, kind of incognito. Here I am, a prince. I'm within reach of the throne. Clearly, God put me here. And then he went, and when he saw a taskmaster mistreating one of his Hebrew brethren, he murdered the taskmaster, but then the people turned on him. The Pharaoh found out about it. He had to flee as a fugitive. Moses was rejected by his people. He left, and he returned. So we've had a second coming of Moses. They're expecting a second coming of Elijah. Is it really such a stretch to say that the Messiah might have a second coming as well? Well, speaking of the Messiah's second coming, and here I want to get back to one of the comments I read from one of my listeners when he warned us that if Christians aren't careful in this election, we could start seeing some persecution because of some of the court cases that have been coming down against Christians lately, and because one more liberal president could tip the balance of the Supreme Court. We won't be a republic anymore. We've been talking about that a lot recently on the show. A lot of my fellow Christians have no problem with that because they believe they're living in the last days before Christ is going to return. Now, Christ is going to return. I'm not a skeptic. I believe in his second coming because he promised a second coming, but I believe in everything he said and everything he promised. And one of the things he said is no man knows the day or the hour. And yet people write books and make predictions. And a lot of people are assuming that we're the last age. One of the reasons they assume that is that Israel became a nation again. Now that was an incredible miracle. And it was a miracle that was actually predicted in the Bible. The prophet Isaiah actually predicted that there would be three different nations of Israel. The first nation of Israel was under David and Solomon as kings. The second nation of Israel after the Babylonian exile, 70 years later, but then it existed for 400 years before Christ came, and then wasn't around much after the death and resurrection of Christ. Prince Titus and the Roman Legion destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. There were subsequent revolutions after that. Eventually, the Jews became conquered, murdered, sold into Roman slavery, scattered. A remnant remained in the land of Israel, but only a remnant. And then in 1947 to 1948, against incredible odds, with every Arab nation in the area practically surrounding them like Old Testament times, saying we're going to wipe out every Jewish man, woman, and child, Israel became a nation again. That would be a marvelous thing to behold, even if we just observe it. The fact that in Isaiah chapter 11, they predict that there will be three different Israels, that's pretty fantastic. But some Christians take a leap beyond that, and they say, since this is the third nation of Israel, and a fulfillment of prophecy. This is probably the final nation of Israel that'll see the coming of Christ. And they based that on the fact that for Christ to return, he was going to return to Israel and save her from persecution. When there was no Israel for the last 2,000 years, people said, well, how could that happen? There is no Israel. When Israel became a nation again, it was very easy for people to assume that God brought Israel back in preparation for the second coming of Christ, just as our 2020 hindsight tells us that the second nation of Israel after Babylon was brought back probably in preparation for the first coming of Christ. And yet, the first coming of Christ happened 400 years after the second temple period, 400 years after Israel became a nation again. So how do we know it won't be another 400 years this time? How do we know it won't be 1,000 years? How do we know Israel won't get destroyed and scattered and brought back and there won't be a fourth nation of Israel? You see, we're just not that sure of our facts. Christ could come. He could come in our generation. It would not surprise me at all. But I don't live my life expecting that to happen. I live my life saying if it happens, that's wonderful, and I want to be ready because he could come. But I'm also aware of the fact that this world could be around a long time. And I must ask myself, what kind of country am I leaving to my children? What kind of country am I leaving to my grandchildren? And persecution is not something that we're supposed to cooperate with. It is something that Jesus told us we would have, but the Apostle Paul also told us to be willing to pray for kings in high places so that we may live a peaceful life. He said, this is good and acceptable in the sight of God, our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. But Jesus did predict that there would be persecution, and we'll look at this passage that predicts it when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. A home? Selling a home? It goes without saying that you need somebody experienced and skilled, but you also need a realtor you can trust, a man who will look out for your interests as if they were his own. This is Bob Siegel here to steer you the right direction with just two words, Fred Felduti. Fred works with Realty Executives All Area, a company that has sold thousands of homes locally since 1994. Putting your home up for sale or selling a home can be stressful, filled with decisions you never anticipated. So put your mind at ease and call Fred Felduti. He sold my home for me at top price. Every step along the way, I benefited from his wisdom and a very generous usage of his time. By the way, Fred Felduti received the Executive of the Year Award for 2014. What? You say that was a couple of years ago? Listen, wise guy, do you want to mark the calendar or do you want somebody to sell your home for you? Whether buying or selling, the man you want is Fred Felduti with Realty Executives All Area, 619-401-2150. That's 619-401-2150 or fredfelduti.com.
This is Dana Ray, a reoccurring co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, here to tell you about Bob's latest novel, The Dangerous Christmas Ornament. What kid could resist the chance to wish for anything he wanted, even if he knew he was flirting with certain danger every single time he made the wish? 12-year-old Mike Owens has received a special present from his eccentric Aunt Lorene, a magic Christmas ornament. The ornament functions as a kind of Aladdin's lamp, but with a unique twist. Each time Mike's wish is granted, something bad happens to a person who is with him at the time the wish was spoken. This, of course, sets up a chain reaction of trouble and adventure. Weighing his own desires against the consequences to those around him, Mike learns a valuable lesson about choices and personal responsibility while experiencing a nonstop adventure with extremely unusual turns. The Dangerous Christmas Ornament, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
We're going over a variety of biblical themes today, and right now we're on the theme of persecution. In John chapter 15, we read Jesus' parting words with his disciples before he went to the cross. He had a little more to say to them after he resurrected, but he is about to leave them for a while and go to the cross. This is what we call the famous Last Supper. And he's predicting that there will be persecution. He says, if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name, for they do not know the one who sent me. No Christian involved in persecution could say that he had not been warned. On this point, Jesus was very clear. And that wasn't the only place he said it in John. I'm reading from Mark 13, 9 through 13. You must be on your guard. You will be handed over to the local councils and flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Whenever you are arrested and brought to trial, do not worry beforehand about what to say. Just say whatever is given you at that time, for it is not you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Now, the first persecution that came from the Romans was reported by a man named Tacitus. Actually, if you read the book of Acts, you see the first persecutions came from the Jewish nation. There was a big split in Israel. The Jewish leaders had rejected Jesus, but a lot of the populace had accepted him. And right now, the Romans were kind of the peacemakers. The Romans were kind of the police. They were breaking up the mobs and riots. They were actually protecting the persecuted Christians. When the Romans were finally fed up with Israel and all of her rebelliousness and destroyed Israel as a nation, Christianity, the brand new religion, no longer had the protective umbrella of Judaism over it. And so in time, Romans began to take notice of Christians in their own right. Now, Tacitus lived between AD 55 and 117. He wrote several books, but I'm reading from one called The Annals of Rome, where he's talking about the time of Nero. Emperor Nero was the first Roman emperor to persecute Christians. He was going to be the first of many, unfortunately. Now, you've heard about the Great Fire of Rome. There's actually disagreement among the ancient Roman historians, people who live close to the time. There's actually disagreement as to whether or not Nero actually started the fire. But what we do know is that the Roman population believed he started the fire and blamed them for it. For this reason, Nero was going to look for somebody else to blame it on. And I'm reading now from the words of Tacitus. Nero looked around for a scapegoat and inflicted the most fiendish tortures on a group of persons already hated for their crimes. This was the sect known as Christians. Their founder, one Christus, that's just the Latin word for Christ, Christus had been, now this is interesting because this is, Tacitus is not only not a Christian, he's a religious man who believes claims of the supernatural, or he actually calls them superstition, and yet he's reporting that Jesus actually existed. This is very important, folks. Their founder, one Christus, had been put to death by the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. This checked the abominable superstition for a while, but it broke out again and spread not merely through Judea, where it originated, but even to Rome itself, the great reservoir and collecting ground for every crime of depravity and filth. Those who confessed to being Christians were at once arrested, but on their testimony, a great crowd of people were convicted, not so much on the charge of arson, but of hatred of the entire human race. So isn't that interesting? Here's a guy who's talking, and the only reason he's even looking into Jesus is because he's noticing that Christians are making police news. They're being arrested. They're being executed. He would have gone, we know he was a very careful historian, he would have gone into the imperial archives and checked the documentations of Pontius Pilate's reign before reporting that. So there was a Pilate. He did execute a man named Jesus. And this is being written by somebody who believes religion is superstition. He calls it that. He says, this checked the abominable superstition for a while, but it broke out again. Now, that's interesting. If the death of Jesus stopped and checked the superstition for a while, what would cause the superstition, so-called, to break out again? Evidently, he's talking about the claims of the resurrection of Jesus, although they're claims he doesn't personally believe. He is one of several ancient historians to talk about the resurrection or the claim of the resurrection. Now, there's another person. He didn't write as much about Christians, but he said a little bit. His name was Suetonius. He lived between AD 69 to AD 140. Also wrote about the time of Nero and other times. He says, punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. There's that word again. So we have another person referring to Christianity as people that are claiming something about the supernatural. He also says something very interesting in the lives of the Caesars when he's talking about the emperor Claudius. Claudius was the emperor that came before Nero. Claudius didn't persecute Christians, but he did banish the Jews from Rome. He says, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from Rome. That's an interesting name, Crestus. Some believe it's a misspelling of the word Christus, and that this too is a discussion about Jesus. By the way, that corroborates something we read about in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 18, it says, after this, Paul left Athens and came to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. So there's something in the Bible that's very corroborated by Roman history outside the Bible. The accusations that Romans made against Christians were very interesting. First of all, they were called disloyal citizens. Now, we think we're so bright in the 21st century, but not that much has changed. In ancient Rome, the Romans, they conquered much of the Western world, and every country they conquered practically had their own god. There were the Greek gods, there were the Asian gods, there was the Jewish god. The Romans didn't have a problem with their people worshiping different gods, but what was interesting is a lot of people loved Rome. You know, they're always the bad guys in the movies, but under the Romans, there was protection, there was a paved road, there were postal systems, there were hotels, or what they called inns in convenient locations. If you were a citizen, it wasn't that bad living under the Romans, and some people were so grateful to the Romans that they actually came up with this idea that the Roman emperor, the Caesar, as they called him, was God. And that didn't mean they believed that some god from heaven came down and incarnated himself. They just believed that this special spiritual Roman god spirit came upon an emperor when he received his title. Now, at first, the Roman Caesars were embarrassed by this, but their handlers and politicians and focus groups got together and said, look, there's a lot of different religions and a lot of disunity that we could have. If we could have one religion as a unifying factor, then let's let people call you God. So what did they do? They said, we're open-minded enough Christians to accept your Jesus, but we want you to be open-minded enough to accept other beautiful religions, such as the Roman emperor being God. And by the way, we're going to execute you if you don't worship him. We might be facing persecution again someday, folks. It was promised. Let's not cooperate with it. But if it comes, we need to trust God. He will still be on his throne.
Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.